He said the insidious threat to liberty will come from those well-meaning people of zeal who have little understanding of what the Constitution is about.
Talking point and conservative jargon is basically invented and then propagated into the organizations. There are 80 conservative organizations that hold a meeting every Wednesday morning in Washington.
It was Mr. Rove who called at least six journalists and Bob Novak to get this information out on the wires in order to attack and intimidate Joseph Wilson, one of the chief critics of this war to date.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, October 1st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraqi police opened fire in downtown Baghdad today after demonstrators stormed a police station demanding jobs they claim to have paid bribes for. According to the Toronto Star, when the gunfire stopped after about 30 minutes, fistfights broke out between some demonstrators and police. At least one demonstrator was injured in the shooting, but his condition was not known. The protesters said they had been promised police jobs in July, in some cases having paid bribes for them, but the positions had not been given out. Senate Republicans press for speedy approval of President Bush's request for $87 billion in Iraq and Afghanistan, even as some GOP lawmakers question whether Iraqis should be required to eventually pay back some of the money. Opening Senate floor debate on the proposal today, Senator Thad Cochran, a Republican from Mississippi, described Bush's request as a matter of urgency. Noting a series of Democratic amendments narrowly rejected by the Senate Appropriations Committee, Cochran said, quote, "I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to reconsider some of the suggested changes on the floor of the Senate." End quote. One of those amendments by Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota, called for Iraq to use future oil revenues to leverage loans to pay for some of the rebuilding costs. Though defeated in a 15-14 party line vote, similar proposals will probably reemerge on the Senate floor. Congressional lawmakers clashed today over whether the Bush Justice Department could fairly investigate allegations that a senior White House official illegally leaked the name of an undercover CIA operative. The agent was Valerie Plame, and critics suspect that White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove was the one who revealed her identity to New York Times columnist Robert Novak last July. They say it was in retaliation for the outspoken criticism by Plame's husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, of the faulty intelligence used by the Bush administration to justify the war in Iraq. The CIA dispatched Joe Wilson to the African country of Niger in February 2002 to investigate claims that Iraq had tried to purchase weapons-grade uranium. Wilson reported back that the charges were without merit, yet President Bush used the Niger claims in his 2003 State of the Union address to dramatize the nuclear threat he claimed Iraq possessed. Wilson went public with his criticism, and 1 week later, Novak's column appeared. Congressional Democrats today demanded that the Bush administration appoint a special counsel to investigate the leak, which is considered a felony offense punishable by up to 10 years in imprisonment. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with William Rivers Pitt, author and columnist with the website truthout.org, to get some background info on the case.
Several months before the war in Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld, who is the defense secretary, organized something within the Defense Department called the Office of Special Plans. Now, this Office of Special Plans was staffed by rank intelligence amateurs, people who have never been in the business before, whose only pedigree for having the job is that they were ideologically aligned with Mr. Rumsfeld. In other words, they were a group of people who had already made a decision to go to war in Iraq and were shopping for whatever reasons they could find to justify the decision they had already made. Now, this Office of Special Plans had absolutely no congressional oversight because it was a civilian group. Yet, in the end, its views on what was going on in Iraq managed to win out over the intelligence being offered by the State Department and the CIA. Intelligence, I might add, that was vastly different from what it is that the Office of Special Plans told. The reason they were able to do this is because their patron saint was none other than Vice President Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney went down to CIA headquarters on several occasions to browbeat the analyst for, quote, forward-leaning, unquote, intelligence to describe the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. This in and of itself is unprecedented and incredibly dangerous. the policymakers should not and do not and must not go down to where the analysts live and browbeat them for a specific kind of information. The analysts are supposed to deliver the information, and the policymakers make their decision from there. The last time this happened was during the Vietnam War. So the Office of Special Plans, because of the patronage of guys like Dick Cheney and to a lesser extent Don Rumsfeld, in the end managed to have their version of the weapons threat posed by Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi connections to Al-Qaeda, and the ease with which we will take over Iraq and make it into a wonderful country. That perspective of the Office of Special Plans won out over the State Department and the CIA. And all of the information that we heard, both from the New York Times, from a lot of the mainstream media, from the president, from the National Security Council, and from every spokesman for this administration, was boilerplate information put out by the Office of Special Plans. That information has turned out in the aftermath to have been absolutely positively wrong. For example, there are no weapons of mass destruction that we can find. They're not there. There are no connections to Al-Qaeda. They're not there. And obviously, the reconstruction effort in Iraq has been much more dirty and hard and bloody than we were led to believe. What does this have to do with what is going on between Joseph Wilson, his wife, and the CIA? Is simply this. Joseph Wilson was asked by the CIA, Dick Cheney asked the CIA to go down to Niger to find out whether or not there was any substance to the claim that Iraq was trying to procure uranium yellow cake from Niger for a weapons program. The CIA got a hold of Joseph Wilson through his wife and sent him down to Niger in February of 2002. He spent 8 days down there and came back and said there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that these Niger uranium claims are accurate. He told Cheney's office, he told the State Department, he told the CIA, he told the National Security Council. And yet, the information about the false information about the uranium from Niger, which was based upon some very crude forgeries, as it turned out, was used by George W. Bush in the State of the Union address. And this is where this starts to heat up, because he used that information in the State of the Union address in January. This past July, Joseph Wilson, who had been the man who went down there and proved that the Niger information was false, wrote an article for the New York Times about his experiences down there and about how the administration began, or that the administration used false, manufactured, weak, useless evidence to justify their war. 1 week later, Bob Novak writes his column outing Wilson's wife Valerie Plame as a CIA analyst, as a CIA operative. Over the course of the same period of time, the White House starts to take a lot of heat about the fact that they used this false information, and began to take a lot of heat in general about the fact that none of their claims about the weapons, none of their claims about Al-Qaeda, none of anything that they had said was turning out to be true. So the White House turned around, the White House and Don Rumsfeld turned around and blamed the CIA. Now, bear in mind what I told you before about the Office of Special Plans. For months and months and months, the information coming from the Office of Special Plans was all the information that was used. The CIA and the State Department and their whole intelligence network was completely usurped and cut out of the loop. And the Office of Special Plans was preeminent in the disbursement of information to the American people through the president, through the Department of Defense, and through everybody else. When they got caught in having been completely wrong and, in fact, in manufacturing evidence, they turned around and tried to scapegoat the CIA. Now, the CIA completely knew about the Office of Special Plans, and they were not going to sit back and take getting scapegoated lightly. So what we have here, in a lot of ways, with this Joseph Wilson situation, is open warfare between the CIA and the White House and its Defense Department. The CIA is not going to sit back and allow itself to get scapegoated by these people in the White House. And the Joseph Wilson situation has given them the lever that they have needed to apply pressure upon this White House for the incredibly stupid attempt to try to scapegoat the CIA. Over and above all of that, that's kind of the inside baseball of all of this. What we have in this situation is a White House that has put the national security of the United States at risk. Valerie Plame, who was Joseph Wilson's wife, was not an analyst, was not some sort of data cruncher. I've gotten this from two different sources at CIA, coupled with Mr. Novak's own words in his July article. She was an operative. In fact, she was a deep cover operative running a network dedicated to sussing out and stopping weapons of mass destruction falling into the hands of terrorists. the hypocrisy of this situation is manifest. We have an administration whose hood ornament for the last year has been defending the United States against weapons of mass destruction, and we had to go to war in Iraq because of that. As it turns out, all the information about Iraq's weapons threat has turned out to be nonsense. Yet, at the same time, in order to protect the president from being attacked by a critic about his use of false evidence in the State of the Union address, a political operative in the White House attacked his wife in order to shut him up and in order to shut up any other critics that might have been interested in coming forward. In the process, they destroyed a very, very valuable network that was used to stop weapons of mass destruction from falling into the hands of terrorists. It's an angle that is not being reported on nearly enough in the mainstream media. It deserves a lot more attention because these people have put us all in a lot more danger. Who did it? The big question. Who is the leaker? A lot of people want to go after Bob Novak for writing the story, but if you look at the Supreme Court case United States versus New York Times, Mr. Novak, even though he has breached a number of ethical walls here, has protections under the First Amendment and under U.S. v. New York Times for having revealed this information. Mr. Novak is not important. What is important is figuring out who it is that leaked this in the first place as an act of political vengeance that has put this entire nation in danger. And Julian Borger, a reporter from The Guardian, has published a story and has said on BBC Radio that there were six other journalists who were contacted besides Novak with this information. Those six journalists, according to Borger, are saying that it was Karl Rove who did this. People might ask, why would Karl Rove have any kind of access to classified information? It's not that uncommon. First of all, in the Kennedy administration, the Karl Rove of that time was a guy named Ken O'Donnell. And Ken O'Donnell was completely involved in all of the secret, super sensitive information surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was there the entire, every step of the way, because he was the political advisor. Karl Rove is 100,000 times more powerful in this administration than Ken O'Donnell was in the Kennedy administration, because everything in this administration is spun through the prism of politics. And politics is Karl Rove's business. He's the senior political analyst. He would have had this information, and according to Mr. Borger and the reporters who Mr. Borger is quoting, it was Mr. Rove who called at least six journalists and Bob Novak to get this information out on the wires in order to attack and intimidate Joseph Wilson, one of the chief critics of this war to date. Karl Rove has a great history of personal attacks. He's a disciple of Lee Atwater, who is the world heavyweight champion of political assassins. One of Karl Rove's more recent attacks, which is actually interesting and revelatory in this particular situation, was he, back in 1992, he was involved in the George Bush Sr. campaign. Mr. Rove had a problem at the time with a gentleman named Robert Mosbacher, who was the chief fundraiser for the Bush campaign and an avowed Bush loyalist. Rove had a problem with this guy, wanted to get rid of him, and in order to do so, he planted a negative story about Mr. Mosbacher in order to tear him down with Bob Novak. So this is a pattern. It has happened before. This is also the same person, Mr. Rove, who in one of his campaigns stole the letterhead from his campaign, from the opposing campaign, and sent out a memo to a bunch of homeless people and alcoholics out on the street saying, free beer, free food, free sex at the X campaign. Come on down and party. And it turned into a major scandal. He got caught for it and said it was a practical joke. He also played some trick where the day before an election where he was supporting another candidate, he claimed to have found a bug in his office and caused this big brouhaha, and the other guy who supposedly planted the bug lost the race. It was determined later that Karl Rove basically grabbed the bug himself and made a big to-do about it. This guy has no ethical base and no ideology beyond power. It is entirely probable that he did this. People may ask, why in the world did he do this? Didn't he know he would get caught? The response to that is, of course he didn't think he would get caught. And if you think about the world through Karl Rove's eyes, you think about the major investigative bodies in the United States government are in his left pocket and his right pocket. The Justice Department completely belongs to his people. The Congress completely belongs to his people. There is no official body on the face of the earth with the ability to investigate somebody like Karl Rove doing something like this, and so I am sure he thought he was perfectly safe. It's also a fairly safe bet that he was fairly angry at Mr. Wilson, because Mr. Wilson was causing him no end of trouble. Joseph Wilson is not a guy that you can lightly brush aside. This guy is a career diplomat. He's an ambassador. He was, in fact, the last American diplomat in Baghdad before the first Gulf War, and received a cable from George Bush Sr. lavishly praising him for his, quote, patriotic work. So this is not some wild flake. This guy has been in the business for a long time. There are a lot of people trying to smear him as being a Democrat because he gave money to the Kerry campaign. He also was very much involved in various Bush campaigns. He is what he is. He's a diplomat with an enormous amount of integrity whose wife was attacked and put in danger as a means to quiet him down. And looking at the history of Karl Rove, up to and including the fact that he attempted to tear down Robert Moshbacker by planting a negative story with Bob Novak, we have a situation where the paths down this road have been well worn.
William Rivers Pitt is a columnist with the website truthout.org. He's also the co-author with former Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. David Brock, described by his friends as a notorious right-wing hitman and partisan attack machine, tells all in his latest book, Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Brock had a career that spanned two presidents, the first Bush and Bill Clinton, and worked diligently to promote and defend the policies and ideas of the ultra-conservative right. When he wrote his book, The Seduction of Hillary Rodham, he found himself out in the cold. Peace Watch spoke with Brock recently about his former life as a right-winger and about the increasingly conservative media coverage of the peace movement and the war on Iraq and issues of the day.
The story that I tell is kind of an inside story of the effort by Republican conservatives, first with the issue of trying to control the courts during the first Bush administration, and then the campaign against President Clinton in the 90s. What was going on the inside organizationally, how it was funded, and what the execution strategies were. My role was, I was in various different conservative publications, beginning at the Washington Times, moving to the American Spectator with a stint in between there at a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. But it was basically as a propagandist. I called myself a journalist, but that really wasn't it, and that wasn't really what anybody was doing that I was working with in those publications, to publicly execute the strategy of first defending the judicial nominees of the first Bush administration, particularly Clarence Thomas. And then, beginning very early on when Bill Clinton first announced for the presidency, there was an awful lot going on below the radar screen by people who were connected to Newt Gingrich, who were financing these so-called journalistic investigations of the Clintons that ultimately some of them did become published. And, mm-hmm. And then I describe not only what the goals of the conservatives were in the Clinton administration, but how conservatives, including American Spectator, including some of my own work, were able to alter the consciousness of the mainstream press and able to essentially, in some ways, co-opt that press into fulfilling the agenda of the right wing.
When you say you were able to alter the consciousness of the mainstream press,
right?
How would you even begin to accomplish something like that?
Well, I'll give you an example. One of the first stories that I wrote for the American Spectator on Clinton was the so-called Troopergate scandal. And that involved allegations by his former bodyguards of his personal past indiscretions while he was governor of Arkansas. Now, that issue really hadn't been broached in the mainstream press up to that point. Certainly some reporters poked around, but no one published anything. The floodgates opened as a result of Troopergate. I had mentioned in passing in that article a woman named Paula, who ended up being Paula Jones. So that article triggered her lawsuit against Clinton. And in fact, the day the Troopergate story was released, it was featured on CNN that evening. And so there was a process by which what had been, I think, some of the normal or typical journalistic standards were worn down by the conservative campaign against Clinton. And I certainly don't think that you would have seen that kind of tabloization of mainstream press if the conservatives hadn't pushed the envelope first.
So it was your job to raise the issues and write the stories. Was there some sort of mechanism in place that would move that information? Was there a pipeline? You said it ended up on CNN that night. Was that part of a strategy, a planned strategy, or just coincidence?
It was. And that goes back to really a strategy that I had learned from the publisher of my first book. My first book was a book that was extremely critical of Anita Hill and supportive of Clarence Thomas. That was a conservative-oriented publishing imprint called the Free Press. And there were specific strategies that were discussed in terms of the promotion of that book to inject the conservative point of view into the mainstream press. And one of those strategies was to say that the book was objective when it wasn't, and a certain smoothing out of the rhetoric to make it more palatable for the mainstream, even though the messages were the same.
Now, did anyone actually give you those directives to say that this book is objective if it's not?
Yes.
It's not?
In fact, there was a media coaching session that I went through for that book, and that is how I was coached. And I don't think I was the first one to go through that.
And so with regard to this war with Iraq, now that you're out in the cold, so to speak,
right?
Can you kind of see the invisible lines or strings being pulled between the mainstream media and the conservatives? Do you see connections there? What is your thinking about what is taking place with the way this particular war is being portrayed in the media?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think that the conservative media, and by that I mean most of talk radio, most of the discussion on cable television, and the op-ed pages in the country, I think the conservative media increasingly is setting the tone for the rest of the discussion. And I see that in the war. I see that in a lot of places, but particularly with the war. And so I think there's been a tendency among Democrats and liberals to not pay so much attention, for example, to what's said on some of these more extreme right-wing radio shows. And I think that's a mistake, because I do think that you can't have that kind of noise going on day in and day out and entering, you know, affecting the atmosphere without it having some spillover effect. For example, the questioning of the motives of people who are against the war, the questioning of their patriotism, these things have come out of the conservative world, but I do think they've affected and had kind of a bit of an intimidating effect on the rest of the press. So that's one dynamic. There are specific strategies. For example, after the tragedy of 9/11, there's a group called the Media Research Center, which is a right-wing media monitoring organization. And in their direct mail, they talk about their specific strategy after 9/11 to target people in the mainstream press and to question their patriotism if they were not fully supportive of what President Bush was doing in terms of the war on terror.
Can you think of any specific examples where that actually happened?
Yes, there was one. I mean, there was more than one, but Peter Jennings was asked in some sort of forum a question, and his answer was that Americans have different views of patriotism. And the Media Research Center got that quote, and they said in their statement that Jennings was a Canadian, had Canadian citizenship, and was not an American, and was betraying the fact that he was unpatriotic in that statement. And so I think those things are happening, and I think the effects are, you know, subtle. They're not that easy to document, but mm-hmm. I believe in the back of the minds of producers, and I think particularly with television more so than print, they are very conscious of being accused of being insufficiently mm-hmm. supportive of America. And mm-hmm. what the right wing has been able to do is to kind of conflate, you know, support for the country with support for Bush's policy.
Who are the David Brocks out there now in the mainstream media?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, there are an awful lot of them. There was a whole group of younger conservative pundits, I guess, who came of age around the time I did, and after Newt Gingrich came into power in Congress, I think was really when they became to be more prominent in the media. The Ann Coulters, the Laura Ingrams, the Jonah Goldbergs of the world. And, you know, they are now, you know, a very steady presence. Some of them have their own talk radio shows. Some of them are on cable. Many of them publish books of the type that I used to publish, which are very successful because there's definitely a, you know, there's definitely a conservative niche market that, you know, I mean, the way I think it works is that there's a large constituency on the right for books and articles and talking heads and talk show hosts who tell them what they already believe, that in other words, that reinforce their own prejudice. And I don't think you have such a vigorous demand for that on the liberal side, because I think liberals tend to want to be challenged more and to be offered information from which they'll make up their own mind rather than being told what to think.
Are these subtle inaccuracies that you detect in the work of these so-called journalists on the right, or are they blatant lies? How would you describe the propaganda, quote-unquote, that you say you were responsible for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the conservative press operates without very much scrutiny by the rest of the press and by the rest of us. And I think that if you took the case going back to Anita Hill, I got away with an awful lot when I wrote that book. And that was 12 years ago. And I think if you look at take the past, you know, the recent conservative best-selling books, for example, if you looked at Ann Coulter's book of last year called Slander, there are entire internet sites devoted to the problems and the falsehoods and the inaccuracies in that book, and that's not just Ann Coulter. That would include, I think, the vast majority of these conservative-oriented books. It's worse when conservatives don't have to put their ideas in print. In other words, I think they're a bit more careful in print than they are on the air. Now, unfortunately, you know, there's not really a fact-checking mechanism out there for much of what goes on conservative talk radio. But I listen to a fair amount of it even still. And I think if there was a fact-checking mechanism, one would find that there's an awful lot that goes on there that's not only, you know, over the top in terms of the type of speech, the hate speech, but just that are just flatly things that are just not right, that are false. But it disappears into the ether. And so there's really, they operate, as I said, with a kind of impunity.
Are there any actual meetings or common planning strategies that you recall from the past that could explain or sort of underscore this kind of coziness between the Democrats, the right-leaning Democrats and the conservatives?
Not really between the right-leaning Democrats and the conservatives. I mean, there's a lot in my book, and this is still going on today. The book talks about the 90s, but I certainly know that it's not out of date in terms of the organizational strategies of the conservatives and how they coordinate their messages, how talking points and conservative jargon is basically invented and then propagated into the organizations. There are 80 conservative organizations that hold a meeting every Wednesday morning in Washington. And so that's how there's a certain kind of unity.
80 conservative organizations that meet in Washington?
Wednesday mornings, yeah.
In Washington.
And that's where things are prioritized. That's where issues are spun.
Is this one major meeting? Or?
It is one major meeting. There's a fellow named Grover Norquist who's the head of something called Americans for Tax Reform, and he has put together this conservative coalition, and it really runs the gamut from the National Rifle Association to pro-life groups to the foreign policy hawks, and they do come together, and there is this kind of coordination, and I can see the results of that, you know, just by reading the press and by watching television, that there are certain ways of speaking that are replicated across the board. And so, you know, one of the ways they've done this is by having so many conservative outlets all saying the same thing, it tends to lead people to conclude, well, if all these people are saying the same thing, they must be onto something. And so it's kind of almost decentralized in a certain way. The messaging and the coordination comes from a central point, but then everybody goes out and does the same thing. Now, I haven't seen right-leaning Democrats in coordination with the conservatives. I really feel it's been a process, as you said, because of the superior organizational ability of the conservatives. Basically, it's just whatever you want to call it, the zeitgeist or the conventional wisdom is moved to the right, and then Democrats react to that. They're only operating in the climate that exists, in the real climate. And in this climate, it takes an awful lot of guts to dissent. And, you know, I don't know if I was in office whether I would have the guts to enter that media climate and dissent. And so that's really the very frightening aspect of what the conservatives have created. They've created this media universe, and it sets the terms. It says what's acceptable to talk about and what isn't. And then the Democrats are kind of beaten down and follow along. And, you know, it's going to take not only finding some leadership and some people who will stand up and not be worried so much about, you know, what names they're called, but I think it's going to take a lot of investment by progressives and by Democrats to building some of these institutions that will last, that will be there, that won't be so dependent on, you know, which party is in power, but can actually build a movement that can sustain itself even when, you know, when you don't have the White House.
David Brock, author of The Real Anita Hill, The Seduction of Hillary Rodham, and most recently Blinded by the Right, a memoir of an ex-conservative, former columnist for The Spectator and The Washington Times. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.